In this special episode of In Our Expert Opinion podcast, recorded live at our annual land conference, the estate and trust planning session covered tax policy updates from Washington and focused on proactive steps landowners can take to save taxes and smartly plan their estates. The panel had in-depth conversations on expiring tax deductions, Section 1031 exchanges, estate tax rates and exemptions, how to avoid probate and estate administration, and the Corporate Transparency Act. Those in attendance left with many takeaways to apply to their personal tax and estate situations.
In Our Expert Opinion podcast is brought to you by SVN Saunders Ross & Danza Real Estate, a full-service land and commercial brokerage with almost $4 billion in transactions since 1996.
So I appreciate all of you coming this afternoon to this session. Understand that taxes are the only thing that stand in the way of you in a happy hour. So really appreciate y'all coming in here. And if you need to get up and go use the restroom and get coffee, feel free to do so. We want this to be as interactive and laid back as possible. When we were talking about the breakout sessions at this conference, we thought that we should have one on estate and tax strategies for a couple different reasons. This conference has always, I think, prided itself on being focused on real issues and real land transactions for the prior year, and kind of as a recap of the year that preceded it. And so not just in terms of reporting sales volume and sales data like you'll get in our market report tomorrow, but also real issues that landowners face, issues that we face as real estate professionals. And when we thought about 2021, one of the biggest items that we all dealt with were the numerous tax proposals in the Build Back Better plan. As everybody knows, those proposed changes included things like increased capital gain tax rates, elimination of Section 1031 exchanges, cutting the estate tax exemption in half, taxing unrealized capital gains at death, a creation of a 3% surcharge on certain high-earning individuals. All this didn't get passed, but it still brought to light, I think, the urgency that tax changes can happen very quickly, and we're all having to make informed decisions in the middle of those discussions and that uncertainty. And so, for us as real estate professionals, there were numerous instances where we're evaluating offers with a client, and we're looking at proposed closing dates that are in two different tax years, and all the while these proposed tax changes are out there. And so, you know, for us, it was a big challenge, but also an opportunity for us to help serve our clients and make sure they were aware of the tax proposals that were out there. So again, this was a real issue that we all dealt with in 2021. And so we thought it would be a great topic to talk about at the land conference. Not only were there these big proposals last year, there's also a number of sunsetting tax deduction provisions from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, which was President Trump's tax reform plan. A lot of those deductions were already set to sunset in 2025. And so those are still out there. And so we're going to get into that a little bit, just things that all of us should be aware of when we're making decisions about our land and our businesses. So I'm very honored to be joined by two very knowledgeable and well-respected people in the estate and tax industry here in Florida. Michael Minton is the chair of the Agribusiness and Solar Energy Industry Team for Dean Mead Law Firm. He represents family businesses with an emphasis on generationally owned agriculture businesses. Among many organizations, Mr. Minton is a member of the Water Resource Assessment Team of the Central Florida Water Initiative, a member of the Board of Directors for the University of Florida Foundation, Florida Tax Watch, and the Cleveland Clinic Martin Memorial Health System. He's a past chair of the tax section of the Florida Bar, and a former member of the Board of Directors for the Orlando Economic Partnership. Michael, thanks for joining us today. Sitting to my right is Hugh Daly. Mr. Daly has been in the banking industry for more than 30 years. 21 of those years, he was the president and CEO of Community Bank and Trust of Florida. He is now Mid-Florida Credit Union's North Central Florida Market President. He received his BS in Agriculture from the University of Florida in 1984 and has attended numerous business schools or banking schools in Florida, including the Florida School of Banking at UF, and the Florida Trust School at USF. He serves on numerous local boards and remains very active in community service. Hugh, thanks for joining us today. We're not going to have like a formal presentation like you've seen in other presentations. We want this to be very interactive. If you have questions, raise your hand and ask. We want this to be something that is very impactful to you and that you can take away a few ideas, a few things back to your family's land or your business that you own and operate. So again, we're going to have a formal Q&A at the end, but if you have questions, feel free to stop us and ask. So Michael, start us out. Tell us a little bit about yourself, some of the big issues that you're seeing in the tax and ag industry today in Florida.
As my father used to say, I ran out of degrees and had to go get a job or else I'd still be there. And I've had the pleasure of having my entire professional career with the same law firm, which is pretty rare for lawyers. I've spent 40 years with Dean Mead. And as Tyler mentioned, my practice has been predominantly dealing with generationally owned family businesses. But over the last half of it, I served a tour duty on the South Florida Water Management Governing Board, so I developed an expertise in water law. And then most recently, as you've mentioned, chair our firm's solar and renewable energy team, which has really been an exciting part of the practice of dealing with a different renewable energy aspects. But looking at the last year, in 2021 in particular, it really has epitomized the old Will Rogers famous quote of, "I don't belong to any organized party, I'm a Democrat." And I think that's pretty much what we've experienced over the last year. We've heard of everything. You ran through your list of horrors that as a tax lawyer, you lose 1031, you know, lose step up and basis at date of death, have date of death become a taxable event. You know, those were all things that scared the fool out of all of us as to whether, you know, they would actually get something accomplished and passed. Now that we're beyond that and we're looking at everybody preparing themselves for the next midterm election coming up, and then soon thereafter you're going to have the next presidential election, I think the general consensus is if it requires bipartisanship, it's probably not going to happen. So I think the focus of today on the sunset provisions of Tax Cut and Jobs Act is probably the smart move for us, and think about what are some of the tax planning opportunities we have over the next few years until we have the sunset provisions kick in. And I also think that drove a lot about what happened last year. There were just an awful lot of folks out there who didn't want to take on the political baggage of having made a decision to change the law when they know it's going to change on its own in just a few years and there's going to be a significant tax increase and nobody has to do anything to have that happen. So that's sort of my two bits of where we are right now.
Hugh, same question to you as well.
Okay, thank you, Tyler. I want to thank everybody for being here. I think it's always important that we continuously learn, and Dean hosts this nice conference, which I've never been before, but I can tell by the attendance and some of the other sessions and so forth that you're here to learn, and hopefully we can add a little value. As Tyler said, I've been in banking for about 38 years. I've been in the trust banking for a little over 20 years. And I'm currently serving as the CEO of Southeast Trust Company, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Mid-Florida Credit Union based here in Lakeland. And it all happened through a merger of the former bank that we started, Community Bank and Trust of Florida up in Marion County. So the reason I'm here today is I know a lot of your landowners. I know you've got a lot of experts that you hire for professional advice, and obviously you're out learning on your own, and it's just so important to have a plan. I know Michael already mentioned, you know, everybody had expectations of higher taxes last year. We've all been blessed with a run-up in the valuation of our assets. If you own real estate, if you own cars, if you own boats, I mean, just about everything's been going up in value. And the question has been all year, you know, are we going to get this tax revision? We ended up lucky. We didn't get it, but you can look at the government spending and the way that our government raises money, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out that regardless of it's Republicans or Democrats, we're going to have tax increases. They are on the way. So a lot of the year we spent counseling with our clients, and a lot of the discussions go something like this. I've got a big offer on my property. Should I take it or should I wait? Are the taxes going up? the 1031 question's probably been on everybody's mind. And what we found is that about half of the people that have contracted real estate go out looking for 1031 exchange properties and they can't identify them. And then they're back asking themselves, should I just pay the tax, hold my money, invest in something else, wait for the real estate market to come down? That's a great question, and it gets asked every day, and I don't have a crystal ball. But we have watched the real estate appreciation in this state at such a rate that most people agree it's not sustainable. At some point, you know, we'll level out and potentially prices come down. So the reason I'm here is to talk a little bit about trusts, estate planning, and the fact that we serve as a corporate trustee or institutional trustee. 100 years ago in banking, there were people on the street, and they were appointed to be in control of someone else's personal property. They became a trustee. The person that appointed them was a beneficiary. Probably 50 years ago, and even before I started in community banking, every community bank in the state of Florida probably had a trust officer that kind of handled those things. And today, because of changes in the bank industry, layers and layers of regulation, changes in the tax situation, and also consumer preferences, people are getting a little more knowledgeable. Most of the time, people used to go to a bank with a trust company in it, but now about 16% of the assets under management in the whole country are under sole-purpose trust companies. So if you have any questions about that, I'll be around, and I'd be glad to answer them. I won't try to opine on tax law because I'm not a tax expert, but I can tell you we work with a lot of tax experts. We work with a lot of attorneys, and most of you have good real estate advisors that you're working with. And my whole thing today, if you don't leave with anything else, and sometimes I ask for a show of hands, but I won't, is have a plan. Work on an estate plan, and the most important thing is to have one. Most of you know what happens, or you've heard of a family situation where someone passed and didn't have an estate plan, and it's usually not the way you want it to unfold. So as we go on today, I'd be glad to answer any questions about any of those subjects. Thank you, Tyler.
Yeah, you kind of led me right into the first question for you, which is people in the audience here are anywhere from small landowners to generational family landowners that are at all different points along that estate will trust path. What advice do you have for each of those groups of people in terms of best steps for ensuring that their land is passed the correct way and that their generations that follow will be able to continue in their footprint?
So my best advice is to put together a team of people to help you do that. If you don't have a real good banker or a fiduciary relationship, that's something that I think is important. An attorney that understands tax is important for most of you. The work that your CPA does when they look at your tax returns, look at your income, look at your assets and that kind of thing. So a CPA or an accountant is one of your important team members. Real estate's involved. You want some real estate experts to give you a little bit of advice. But once you have all those people together, it's important that you kind of execute a plan. The will, the living will, a trust if you need one. In all cases, you know, you have to do a plan. I tell people all the time, if you have an attorney drop a will for you, he tells you what's in the will, he gives it to you, you don't understand it, have someone translate it for you. We do that all the time for our clients. We take their documents from their attorneys, translate them, read them back to them, and they say, well, you know, I really don't like this or I really don't like that. And we say, well, we can help you. You know, you can go back to the same attorney and have it modified. Or, you know, my attorney says I need to do this, but I really don't want to do that. And a lot of times it gets into situations where you might have someone that has special needs. There's blended families where you have kids by one spouse and kids by another spouse. All these different things that sometimes can't be covered in a very simple will. So you need to make those estate plans and then check them over. People say, how often should I check them? And I think that was one of the things that he mentioned. I tell people every 3 years or if there's some big lifestyle change, someone passes away, someone gets sick, someone starts failing with their memory, those type things, it might be even quicker. But don't be afraid to dust those off and modify them and get updates and that kind of thing.
That's great advice. Michael, back to you. You mentioned the Trump tax cuts of 2017. A lot of those deductions were, when they were written, they were supposed to be temporary in nature with a phase out over time, basically starting now until 2025 or 2026, depending on the deduction. Which of those do you think is the most critical for people in this room to have a firm grasp of? Are there two or three that you think we should hone in on here today?
Certainly, Tyler. Thank you. We'll talk first about some income tax sunsets, and then we're going to transition into some estate planning sunsets that really dovetails well into what Hugh was mentioning about some planning opportunities to undertake. And then before we get done today, there are a couple of non-tax things that I'd like to hit on that we recommend for planning. One is this whole concept of using a revocable trust as a means of avoiding ancillary probate. We have so many of our Florida residents to own property somewhere else, and if they don't plan properly, they've created a situation where there could be an ancillary probate. I've got an example I'll share with you where, it could have cost the family an awful lot of money had they not taken the advice. And then the last thing I'll address later on at the end of the presentation is this Corporate Transparency Act, which not many people are aware of, that was enacted last year and will come into effect in the not-too-distant future, which deals with identifying the ultimate beneficial owner of every business entity except for those that qualify for the exclusion. So it's a pretty big deal that's found its way here from our friends over in Europe. It's primarily something to keep people from hiding their ownership for transferring of funds and avoiding criminal conspiracy activities, but it flies in the face of a lot of what we preserve around here of having privacy right. about things. So it really interacts. So in the outline, we've provided for you a number of the income tax sunsets. You're going to have the tax rates will revert back to what they were pre-Tax Cut and Jobs Act. The Tax Cut and Jobs Act came in 2017. In 2025 is when we have the sunset. Your standard deductions will revert back, but with some indexing for inflation. State and local taxes, you probably heard a lot about that, the limitation on the deductibility of state and local taxes. It really didn't affect us that much in Florida because we're a relatively low tax state. But there are other states where that'll be a huge issue.
And there's a lot of impact of people moving here because they are New York residents or New Jersey residents or California residents where they're subject to a very high state income tax rate that they can't deduct.
And you'll get back to miscellaneous itemized deductions. And there's a long list in here of those that we won't go into detail on, but those are all things that will go back to the way it used to be. The biggest exception to all of that is the corporate tax rate, which was set at a flat rate of 21%. That's permanent. So that gets to stick around. So the people who got the biggest benefit from the Tax Cut and Jobs Act will continue to get that benefit going forward. To compensate that, smaller businesses, pass-through entities, were able to take a 199A deduction for 20% of their qualified business income. That does sunset. So the provision that they gave the smaller businesses to make them somewhat equivalent to the advantage that corporate tax was going to get received, that right. is one of the things that sunsets.
Slightly unfair provision for LLC owners, partnership owners.
For those of us who are in normal trades of businesses. Yeah. Exactly. Some of the bigger items that we're going to deal with, and this is going to be a surprise for many folks. Okay, so we've had the first-year deduction, the bonus depreciation for a property placed in service. And if you'll notice on page 3 of our outline, there's a phase-out of that starting in 2023, and it phases out over time until it's totally phased out by 2027. And in addition to that first-year bonus deduction, we also had the Section 179 expense, which was for most taxpayers when you bought qualifying equipment or certain types of real estate that you elected to be treated this way. You were able to make a first-year deduction, and there were phase-outs of that. Well, when the bonus depreciation phases out, You know, everybody will be relying pretty much on just the 179 expense going forward. But then couple that with the next provision I highlight for you, Section E, which deals with 1031, the like-kind exchanges. Like-kind exchanges used to apply not only for real estate, but also for equipment. You could, I actually exchanged a gas company for a motel once. We were able to identify enough of the equipment that matched up with the equipment to do a total like-kind exchange. Well, one of those changes that doesn't sunset is the fact that 1031 is only applicable to real estate. So you can only match up real estate to real estate. Well, one of the unintended things that's going to happen is you're going to have a lot of people who have relied on the bonus depreciation or the 179 expense for their new equipment that they've bought. And they're used to being able to exchange the old equipment in a trade-in. And it used to be treated as a like-kind exchange, equipment for equipment, and then you only paid, you got your bonus depreciation on the additional compensation you paid for the balance of it. Well, now that the bonus depreciation is going to phase out and your 179 may not cover it, you're going to find some people are going to be surprised when they exchange a valuable piece of equipment, like an airplane or a boat or a big piece of farm machinery, like a combine, and end up having a taxable event because the basis of what they gave up is less than the value that they're getting in the exchange. And it can have an income tax effect that may not be totally offset by the deduction you get for the new piece of equipment. So that's one that's going to surprise some people. Now, it's not going to happen all the time, and it's going to have to be a pretty large transaction for it to affect someone. But that's just one that's out there that that people ought to be aware of and keep an eye out for. There's a special provision for citrus. And, you know, we've been trying to encourage reinvesting in citrus and replanting of citrus. So 263A, which requires the capitalization of your cost when you plant a new grove until the grove comes into being placed into service, has a special provision entered if you lost a grove to freeze or some other type of event, then you can reinvest in the property and expense it right away. Well, part of the problem is people didn't have a capital to make the new investment, so we encouraged them to allow us to bring other investors. They actually went so far as to say, if you bought the grove from someone who lost it in an event, you as the new owner could expense it as you replanted it. Well, that's one of those special provisions that has a totally different sunset date, but it will sunset, and it'll be December 22nd of 2027. So, very odd date for that to be picked. Problem is, it's hard to find many people that are replacing citrus groves because, you know, you'd have to replace it with the same or similar type of commodity. If they would just say you can replace it with something else that's a perennial, right, that would make a big difference for us. But there's, you know, regrettably, there's so few people who feel confident enough about where we are with the citrus industry that they're willing to replant citrus right now. We have another provision that deals with Section 118 capital contributions by non-shareholders. This is a provision that we use a lot on water projects. So if you're doing one of these dispersed water projects and you're receiving a grant from the government to put this project in, it was able to be treated as a contribution to capital, which was non-income. Well, one of the changes in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act that just seems totally inconsistent with everything else is they repealed that ability to avoid paying tax on that grant. And so after TCJA came in, if you received the grant from a non-shareholder, a governmental entity, and you used it towards one of these water projects, it was taxable income to you. Well, those of us who practice in the area found a way to go around that, to work around that. We ended up doing a lot of long-term leases, and the government, in essence, paid for a leasehold improvement rather than having it be a grant. And so we were able to restructure to avoid it. But that's one of those provisions that is not sunsetting back. But in the infrastructure bill that passed last year, they did make a change, and they reinstituted that provision, which allows you to receive a capital contribution by non-shareholder, but only for public utilities. So it really doesn't help the rest of us that were relying on it, but at least the utilities are able to take that back. The biggest area, and I think this is one that you and I'll probably have a fair amount of conversation on, has to deal with estate and gift tax. Yeah. The rates don't change, but your credit equivalent changes. The credit equivalent is how much you can give during your lifetime or at death and not have to pay a tax on it. You know, each of you get has an annual exclusion that you can give, which is $14,000. Was indexed for inflation. I think it's up closer to like $17,000 or $18,000 now. It's in the outline. But beyond there, your annual exclusion, it's $14,000. Beyond your annual exclusion, you could give a certain amount that actually attracted tax, but you had a tax credit that offset that. And prior to Tax Cut and Jobs Act, we were at $5 million. With the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, it went to $10 million, which is inflation adjusted. So with inflation, that $10 million equivalent is now a little over $12
million. Right, and that's per person.
That's per person. So,
a
husband and wife is $24 million. And those of us who work in the planning area know that if you set up a business and have minority interest, you can get certain types of discounts on valuation for fair market value purposes. So I can take a $24 million credit equivalent and transfer a $50-plus million company and pretty much structure it so it's not going to have a taxable event. Well, that all will sunset after 2025 back to the $5 million, but if it's indexed for inflation, it's going to be more like $7 million. We can still do a lot with that.
Yeah.
But between now and 2025, those people who have the ability can do some significant asset transfer, wealth transfer, by utilizing that credit equivalent. And one of the provisions that we were concerned about at the tax section when I was chair was the issue of, well, if we take advantage of that credit now and it sunsets, are you going to try and claw it back when we die? And what will happen is you make a gift before 2025 and take advantage of the credit equivalent, but then when you die, they revert you back and they gross up everything you've given during your lifetime plus what you still have at death, and in essence claw back those assets and then hit it with a new credit equivalent, you could be taxed at death for things you gave a long time ago. The IRS came out with a pronouncement that said they aren't going to do any clawback for any transfers that are made pre-2025. So there's a real window of opportunity for people who want to look at their estate planning and make some changes to effectuate some rather significant transfers of wealth. And there are ways that you can supersize that, for lack of a better term, by right. using valuation discounts, by using different type of trusts and things of that nature.
Right. And within the ag context of that, with people owning high-valued land, right, we've seen land appreciate over time, but we've also all heard stories of people who own a lot of land and not have the money to pay an estate tax at death, right, because all that money's tied up in land. Is there anything
right.
landowners specifically you see them doing now in terms of trying to take advantage of that exemption while they're alive in order to kind of get the land transferred while they can exempt as much as they can?
Well, taking advantage of the credit equivalent to make transfers is very important, but also making sure that how you hold the balance of it is important too, because we do have other tools that we can work with when it comes time to address tax. There's special use valuation, which we can use to reduce the value at death. And there's also, once you get to the point where you're going to have a tax regardless, there's 2032A, which allows you, so long as you've structured it so that it's a large enough amount of your estate, that allows you to pay the tax over time period with a very reduced interest rate. So there are a lot of things that we can work with, but the most important thing would be getting that structure in place where you can do your gifts, do as much transfer of moving wealth as you can now, and then deal with what's left.
Yeah.
After the fact.
Hugh and Michael, this question's for both of you. I know you both have thoughts on it. And could you talk about the interplay between a will, a revocable trust, and then also holding property within a legal entity for a lot of the landowners in the room in terms of estate issues?
Certainly. I'll give sort of the legal background, and then you can talk about the practical effects of the trust treatment. That was one of the things I wanted to talk about is avoiding ancillary probate and avoiding probate altogether. If you die and you own property in your own name, it's going to have to go through probate in your will. If you die and you have property in a trust, then the trust acts like your will and will allow that properties to be transferred, and it won't necessarily require a probate. You may still do a probate because you may want to identify creditors that are out there and things of that nature, but you're not doing it to transfer your assets because you've already put your assets in a trust. The important thing of doing this type of planning, though, is make sure that if you go down this path, you actually follow through and title the asset in the name of the trust. I can't tell you how many times I've seen a wonderfully laid out set of documents that has a pour over will and a revocable trust, and it comes time and none of the assets are transferred.
But the actual title.
Exactly.
On the
title of the asset. And so you have to go through the whole process of doing that. If you don't want to use a revocable trust, or you can do a revocable trust and an entity, but you can put property in an entity. And the nice thing about the using revocable trust or an entity is that the laws of the state in which you are domiciled will control over the transfer of those assets. Unlike if you own real estate in, say, North Carolina or Colorado in your own individual name, to transfer the title of that, you'd actually have to do a probate in your state and then take those documents and do an ancillary probate in the other state to make a transfer. And I've got a great example of how this affected a client of ours. A lot of people in this room are old enough like I am to remember the freezes of the 80s. And I was representing the Citrus family. And during the good times, they had great times. And they included the having the house in Steamboat Spring that they all enjoyed to go out and ski and whatnot. But we had a couple of successive freezes, and this particular family had incurred a fair amount of debt to deal with the freezes. And part of the estate planning we had done, we convinced them they needed to do revocable trust and transfer title of the assets in the trust. Well, thankfully for them, they had a buyer who was buying the Steamboat Springs house so that they were going to have the cash to be able to deal with the debt that they incurred to try and rehabilitate the groves. Well, our client passed away just before the closing was to take place. And luckily, they had it in a revocable trust, so the successor trustees stepped into the shoes, and the closing took place like it normally would have, and they were able to get the cash into the estate. Hmm. Had they not, the terrible situation they were looking at is when he passed away, we would have had to start a probate in Florida and then turn around and do an ancillary probate out in Colorado to complete the sale. And the buyer was on the backside of a 1031 transaction. So they had dates that were very important to them. And if the closing didn't take place, and if they weren't willing to go ask the secretary for an extension, which nobody likes to go ask the secretary of the IRS for anything, much less an extension. So they may very well have canceled the contract and moved on to something else. But because we had the ownership in the way we did, they were able to close on time and have the transaction completed and had the liquidity inside the now the revocable trust to handle the debt situation so that we weren't in the worst case scenario, which is having to sell property when the buzzards are circling. When everybody knows you got to sell it, that's the worst time to have to do it.
You know, talk a little bit about the practical side of that in terms of your discussions with landowners and structure.
Yeah, I think one of the big things and a takeaway for you today is I really think we have a window right now to do some serious estate planning. When it gets down to it, it sounds real fancy, and all these irrevocable trust names and so forth are scary. But if you have the right experts, it's all about transferring wealth to your kids, to your beneficiaries. One of the things that happens when you're transferring that wealth from one generation to another is you have to do things that are going to protect people. And I tell people that all the time, and they say, well, protect me from what? Well, what are we doing with all the estate planning? They're protecting you and your family from the IRS. You know, that's the way I like to kind of just put it into plain and simple terms that you understand. Because what you don't pass to the next generation, the IRS or a state taxing agency or someone else is going to get it. So I think when you think about eliminating the burden on your heirs for making these decisions, a lot of us don't like dealing with mortality. And, you know, who in here knows exactly when they're going to pass away? You remember over the last 8 or 10 years when the tax rates were being changed for the credits and people were thinking, well, if I die then, I need to do this. If I die then, I need to do that. Well, I can tell you in the next 3 or 4 years, you need to dust off your estate plan, even if you have a perfect estate plan, because the tax law changes might make big swings and you may have to totally redo your estate. Right. So we said, you know, if you have a death in the family or if you're feeling ill or you think you know, someone in your family is becoming incapacitated or has some of those special needs, those are all triggers that you look at. But the other thing that we didn't mention, and Michael pointed out very clearly, is changes in tax law. So this isn't something you can just dust off, put on the shelf, and hope everything works out. So, you know, when you get right down to some of the things that you can do, I mean, people have special things they want to leave, and it might be a coin collection or special guns and all those different things. And those are the easy things to deal with. Those are the kind of the fun things to deal with. But when you have one piece of land and you have six beneficiaries, those are the more difficult things to deal with.
Right.
And you get the old, have to sell the farm. And, you know, quite frankly, a lot of the people that do business with us don't want to deal with that. They would rather tell us what they want the outcome to be and put it in an irrevocable trust and then have someone else deal with it when they're not here. And quite frankly, that's one way out. It's not probably the best way out, but it does help people get things done. And, you know, the alternative is don't do anything, and that never turns out well.
Well said.
A recipe for just what you got.
Right.
If you don't plan anything.
We have a few minutes left until I open it up for Q&A, so I wanted to make sure we hit on a couple last items. The first one being the Corporate Transparency Act. You mentioned that a second ago.
Right.
This is something that people don't realize is out there and really hasn't gotten as much talk probably as it deserves. And I know you mentioned it briefly earlier, but I wanted to see if you could expound on that a little bit.
Certainly. The end of our outline gets into some discussion of it, but It was enacted on January 1st of 2021 over a presidential veto. So it was a bipartisan enactment to bring this about. And the Corporate Transparency Act is basically a way to, those of us who deal with water management districts have had to deal with this for quite a while. Most of you who deal with the Farm Services and have to fill out those USDA reports as far as being able to qualify for the different type of revenue opportunities. Who is the ultimate beneficial owner of the property? Who is the ultimate beneficial owner of the entity? Getting down to the individual, not just layer after layer after layer. And so this is going to require that type of reporting for all business entities, except for those that qualify for certain exclusions, which are outlined in my materials. But the biggest exclusion is going to be companies that employ more than 20 full-time employees and report revenues in excess of $5 million a year. If you're in one of those entities, you're not going to have to do this type of reporting. But all the rest of us are going to be subject to this reporting requirement.
Is that an or an and? 5 million and 20 employees, or is it or one of the
it's
two?
It's and.
And.
It's
yeah.
20
so
employees, more than 20 yeah. employees, and report revenues of more than $5 million annually. Have to have a physical presence in the United States, but you know, the primary exclusion, it's a pretty large exclusion for a lot of larger businesses, but the smaller family businesses, many of them won't hit that qualification. Now, we don't have to start complying with it until they have finalized the regulations. They have sent out proposed regulations on it, but they haven't been finalized yet. So it will probably be something that is formal by the end of this year, and they're supposed to put out a form that you use for reporting. All new entities that are formed after these final regulations have 14 days from formation to file the report showing who the ultimate beneficial owner is. So it's going to be something that's going to cause some angst out there. You know, it's one thing when we're talking about trying to identify the oligarchs and identify the drug cartels and people who are moving money around, but it's something totally different when you're talking about identifying people who are from Venezuela or from one of the other countries where if someone really knows who the ultimate beneficial owner is, that family may not exist any longer. So it's something I think that requires some real consideration and some review. And the penalties for noncompliance are very stringent and can be criminal, and it can affect those who advise them as well. So it's one of these things that has sort of has crept in with very little pre-notification, but it's going to be something we're going to have to comply with probably by the end of this year.
Right. Thanks for that.
Along those same lines, if anybody has a new entity that they formed in the last couple of years and you go try to open a bank account somewhere, I'm a banker, and they quiz you to the nth degree about beneficial owners and who owns stock in this, and, well, that's a family LLC. Well, who owns stock in that? And, you know, it just gets down to the government's in everybody's business. And from the bank enforcement standpoint, I mean, it's serious penalties for the bank if they don't get the beneficial owner information. And what that boils down to is that's part of the anti-money laundering rules and regulations, Patriot Act, all that, because of a few bad operators. And these poor folks that come from Venezuela and places like that, I know they've had citrus groves here. We've got them up in Ocala with a lot of the horse farms. Most of those people are honest, hardworking people, but my goodness, if they get information, you know, spread around Venezuela, all of a sudden you get a call and one of them's cousins been kidnapped, or, exactly. You know, that it's there's a lot of reasons to appreciate the country we live in, and there's a lot of good things that come as a result of some of these regulations, but so many of these regulations are becoming so onerous that it's difficult to operate for honest people.
Unintended consequences of things that you can't overcome.
Yeah, absolutely. One last topic that I wanted to highlight. It's in your materials here. Obviously, in the last year, there's been a lot of discussion about Section 1031 exchanges. Everybody's familiar with that and knows how that process works. Section 1033 is a little bit different.
Right.
There's a lot of benefits to a landowner on the back end of a Section 1033 involuntary exchange. And so I wanted to see involuntary conversion. I mean, I wanted to see if you could highlight that.
Absolutely.
And explain that a little bit more in detail.
Thank you, Tyler. I wanted to make sure I brought this up. And I try to bring it up every time I speak to a group of landowners and people who deal with transactions. We're all very familiar with 1031 deferred exchange rules and the formalities of the 45 days to identify and 180 days to reinvest. And we've got qualified intermediaries, and we've got all the bells and whistles there to follow through on it. But what people rarely think about is, well, what if it's an eminent domain matter or like you said, a theft or a loss that I got reimbursed for, and I want to use 1033, which allows you to reinvest and not have to recognize and pay gain. You have a two-year window, but if it's a trade or business property, you can extend that to a three-year window to make that reinvestment. And here's where the trap comes in. You have the event. You get the proceeds from insurance, or you have the eminent domain, you have the sale, and before the family can reinvest, the patriarch, whoever the property's in the name, dies. Now, are you going to end up having to pay tax on that gain, or are you going to be able to make the reinvestment and avoid an income tax situation that would now be income tax within the estate? Yep. And not just the estate tax potential exposure.
And that delay can take a long time to get those insurance proceeds. So
exactly.
A lot can happen.
Exactly. A lot can happen. So there is a case out there called the Estate of Jane, where the PR, the personal representative, did such a good job of identifying that they were stepping into the shoes of the taxpayer and completing the reinvestment that the taxpayer had identified he wanted to do, that the court ruled that the estate was able to take advantage of the same rollover treatment and did not have to pay income tax on the proceeds received from that. So we advise our clients that when you have an event like this happen, make a plan. Back to our making a plan.
Document it.
Make a plan, document it, put it in writing. We want to reinvest. We are looking at these types of properties to reinvest. It doesn't have to be nearly as formal as the 1031 identification rules. We don't have anything like that, but you need to make sure you put something in place that gives your successor the ability to make that argument down the road so that you don't get caught in that situation where, oh my gosh, now it's an income tax event and an estate tax event just because we weren't able to complete the reinvestment.
Right, right. It's a great explanation. All right, we'll open it up for Q&As. Does anybody have any questions? And let me just repeat the question. We're recording this. I wanted to make sure that it was documented. The question was, what are our thoughts on annuities from both an income tax perspective and an estate perspective?
Well, from an income tax perspective and an estate tax perspective, we used to utilize a fair amount of annuities on a transfer of asset situation. But we haven't seen it nearly as much of it in the last 10 or 20 years as we did in the early part of my practice. And it really is driven more, I think, from the insurance industry and what type of products that they're putting out as to whether people are willing to make those types of investments. Most of our work has gone more towards utilizing the valuation discounts and utilizing defective grantor trusts and things of that nature, where we're not having to rely on the annuity as a mechanism to transfer wealth and then have it disappear at the time of death. So we don't really use it as much as we did when I first started practicing.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think another thing, just because of the economic times we're in, a lot of the annuity rates have been lower. So when people start looking at the annuity rates, I was honored to serve on the Federal Reserve Board in Jacksonville for about 5 years. And so I'm one of those Fed nerds and keep up with the Fed. And I know there's 6 or 7 more meetings this year. And I know that 50 basis points is what all the financial markets are baking in for the next Fed meeting. I think it's May 3rd and 4th or something like that. And, you know, Bullard from St. Louis came out yesterday and said maybe 75 basis points. So if you don't think interest rates are going up, you're not reading the financial news. And those things get really popular for estate planning and otherwise for investments and that kind of thing as the rates get better. So I think that could have an effect. But I agree exactly with Michael.
Any other questions? The question was about cost segregation studies, our views on them, and whether we recommend them or not. I mean, I'll give my 2 cents initially, and then I'll kick it to you, Michael. But, you know, with bonus depreciation sunsetting after the end of this year, I do think there's a window to maximize the deduction. Cost segregation studies, for those who don't know, is, let's say you buy a commercial building, and it would be traditionally depreciated over a long period of time. A cost segregation study is you go out and hire a engineering accounting firm, and they come in and they look at what makes up that building that you purchased. It's not just the building itself. It's the light bulbs. It's the walls. It's the floors. It's the electric wire, and all those and fixtures and those kind of all those different asset classes have different useful lives for tax purposes. It's not all grouped into one long-term bucket. It's they assign those costs to shorter-term depreciation windows, whether it's 3-year property or 5-year property or 7-year property or 15. Under the current tax policy that sunsets, as Michael mentioned, starting next year, you can write off 100% of those costs. They're 15 years or less, I believe, in the first year. And so there is a window to get those cost segregation study deals done. Michael, I didn't know if you had anything else to add to it.
Just to go back to my comment earlier about the change to 1031 and the fact that it only applies to real property. And oftentimes your cost segregation study allows you to reclassify what historically may have been rolled into the building as real property as a form of equipment or other item that allows you for the bonus depreciation and write-off. You're going to find that some of these 1031 exchanges of what they thought was real property may end up having some non-real property attributes that could cause some income tax consequences that people aren't anticipating.
And that wouldn't have been the case had they not done the cost segregation study, because it would have just been lumped into the cost of the building. Yeah, that's a great point.
So that's going to be a surprise for some folks.
Yeah. Other questions?
When you get a gift, you have a carryover basis, and so when you ultimately sell that piece of property, that's when there's going to be an income tax event. Whereas had the asset gone through the estate under current law, you get a step-up basis to day-to-death value, and that's where you get relieved of that income tax exposure. So you always have to think through when you're structuring these types of planning of, does it make sense to make a gift now and have a carryover basis, or would it be better to have it go through the estate and get a step up? The problem we're going to come up with is that when you go from a $12 million credit equivalent to a $7 million credit equivalent, there's an awful big delta there, and so there are a lot of estates that are going to come to the a lot of families are going to come to the conclusion it's better to go ahead and make the gift and take the low basis than it is to wait for death and have an estate tax event because we don't have enough credit to overcome it all. And it's still one of the biggest planning steps all along is, you know, if it can pass through an estate, you get that step up at date of death. Now, we're doing a lot of planning for basis. You know, you can have assets that are in a partnership. We had this example one of the other presentations we did, where if you've had that partnership around long enough so that you've gone beyond the mixing bowl requirement, you can start distributing assets out to the right person so that you got the low basis asset in the name of the person, the octogenarian or post, who may pass sooner, and put the higher basis assets out to the younger generation that, you know, will have a longer time, you know, horizon before they have to dispose of something, and so you'll get a step up in date of death value for the older generation that may be taking the low basis asset. That's a great planning step.
So I'll kind of wrap it up with this last question for both of you. In the past, we've seen sunset provisions, smaller ones, not as impactful as the ones that we're facing in the next few years, as we've discussed, but those get deferred and extended. We also had midterm elections this year and a presidential election coming up. All that impacts tax reform and future tax policy. Where do you think we're headed?
Did you hear my introduction?
Put your tinfoil hat on.
Epitomize Will Rogers when he says, I don't belong to any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. I think we're headed to another couple of years of lack of cooperation, and of I think we're headed to the sunset happening, and then by then we'll be looking at which, if one party can capture everything, you'll probably get some type of tax provisions. But unless something drastic happens, when you have Republicans who supported the infrastructure bill when it was a Republican bill, having to vote against it when it became a hopefully bipartisan bill, it's very unlikely that you're going to get anything to be bipartisan going forward.
I completely agree. One last question there in the back, actually.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah, I think, you know, there's a million questions about the economy. Just my comment I was getting ready to make when he asked the question, and I'll try to help answer that question, was, you know, if you look at the way the country's going and you look at all the spending and you look at the new spending with the whole, deal in Ukraine and so forth, it doesn't take, again, a high-level accounting mind to know that we have to raise taxes in this country. And again, when you can't determine when you're going to pass away and you think that whether it's Republicans or Democrats, they're going to try to figure out some fiscal balancing of all the expenses that we spend at the federal level by raising money at the federal level, i.e. income taxes, most of those tax conversations are about raising revenues. And you remember this from over and over and over again. It's closing all the loopholes. You have flat taxers. You have fair taxers. You have all these different concepts. But nobody wants to give up a tax benefit, but yet everybody wants everything to be paid for by someone other than themselves. And if you're fresh off a tax day, I know I am and a lot of my clients are, it's a sad day for a lot of guys, and especially if they sold some real estate and things like that in 2021. Tax day, there's a small portion of the folks paying a large portion of the bill. And back to banking, and even when you get into discussions of crypto and these other alternative investments and so forth, I'm not 38 years a banker, and I'm not against regulations, but I am against overregulation. But these cryptocurrencies are not regulated at all. And, you know, you hear discussions about regulatory bodies, even the Fed's looking at some cryptocurrency and that kind of thing, trying to figure out how to analyze them. But I don't know of a real safe place to take all your money when you leave the bank in this country. When you look at the other investments in different foreign governments and so forth, they all think this is the safest place for their money. So I don't have a good answer for that. But I can tell you it's a great time to own real estate. It's a great time to be in the stock market. But I don't know that it's the best time in the world to buy all in into the stock market or into real estate. So you find yourself with all these conundrums, what if, what if, what if. And again, at the end of the day, I think my strategy would be to diversify. Don't have all your eggs in one basket. You know, you can have a little in crypto if that's what you like, or a little in different stocks and bonds and so forth if you care for that at all. Some of it in real estate, some of it in foreign investments, that kind of thing. The one area that I have this huge question mark about is all the money that's invested in these REITs, these real estate investment trusts. You may have some in your retirement or your stock portfolio and so forth. The REITs have been driving the home loan prices up in this state like crazy over the last couple of years, and also commercial real estate prices up. A lot of these real estate investment trusts are the ones coming in here running the prices up and buying things at a 3% cap rate and so forth. And the question is, on the other end, there's investors that are expecting a return, and whether they signed up for 3.5% or 10.5% or whatever they signed up for, these REITs are going to have to continue to pay those returns or show some capital appreciation. And I don't know how all that ends up, because if you have anybody that's been trying to buy a house lately, and, you know, 2 months ago the rates were 3%, today they're 5% on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, it's really cut their budget on the price of the home they can afford. Absolutely. So with these Federal Reserve cuts in the future, I mean, you can't really expect those mortgage prices to come down. And that's going to have some kind of a factor, who knows what, on not only residential real estate, but also commercial and potentially agricultural real estate.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. Does anybody have any other questions?
I was going to put one little plug in there. Historically, one of the greatest hedges against inflation has been investment in real estate.
Yep.
And I'm sure there are some wonderfully talented people at this program
yep.
that will help you find yep. the right real estate to invest yep. in.
1723 Bartow Road, if you want to stop by after work. Thanks to all of you for coming. Michael, Hugh, thank you so much for joining us.
Call Dean Mead for your business law, estate planning, real estate law, or litigation needs toll-free today at 877-363-8992 or visit deanmead.com. That's DEANMEAD.com.